All right. You know, that's Let There Be Drums from Sandy Nelson. But you know what it always reminds me of? It always reminds me of the man with the golden arm, okay? And I just keep thinking about that. And I'll tell you, this is a morning, noon, or afternoon. It sets me off right. Any time of the day I hear that, it just gets everything flowing and gets me in the mood to do what I got to do, what I want to do, which is be here with you today, all right? Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have a really interesting show this week, all right? The back end of the show, we're going to be joined by Wayne Kramer, formerly of the MC5, a revolutionary rock band during the late 60s, early 70s that just blew the hell out of the music scene around the country and other parts of the world. And it was a band that just kicked out the jams as their most popular songs, actually, put it. Well, Wayne is going to be joining Billy Bragg to come in. They're both co-founders of Jail Guitar Doors USA. And Jail Guitar Doors is an organization that is dedicated to getting musical instruments, guitars, and other instruments to prisoners as part of recognizing and upholding the humanity of everyone who's in prison. And they're going to be coming in talking about Jail Guitar Doors. And before that, we'll be talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and co-founder of StopPatriarchy.org, where she'll be reporting on the recently completed Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, and she'll talk about patriarchy and why it's such an essential part, why the system needs it, all right? That's exactly what we'll be talking about. Opening the show up, I'm extremely happy to be welcoming back to the show Larry Everest. Larry's a writer for Revolution Newspaper. He's also the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. He's a frequent guest on the show, and I wanted to have him on because he's been writing quite a bit in Revolution Newspaper about and on revcom.us about what's going on in Syria. It's one of those things that, you know, it's like, yes, a lot of people are talking about it, but you know what? There's a whole lot of stuff going on out there that is clouding things up, that's confusing things, that's missing the point. We need to have some deep understanding about what's really going on. U.S. imperialism led by Barack Obama, that's right, and I'm not from Boston, but we'll just keep calling him Barack Obama, right, because he's earned that title, is about to unleash a military assault against Syria. No matter what they say, this is being done to meet the needs of the U.S. empire. Nothing more, nothing less, all right? And it won't do anything but bring more horror and suffering to the Syrian people. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, good to be with you.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this because I want to have as much time as I can with you, all right? The last couple of weeks, as I was pointing out, the Obama regime has built the drive to attack Syria into a fevered pitch, to attack the Assad regime in Syria and the Syrian people just by the fact that they're there, to a fevered pitch, all couched in a concern for humanity and setting the right standards in the world, the right moral standards in the world. What's the reality here?
Well, first of all, I mean, the leading edge of what they're arguing is that in late August, August 21st, there was a horrific chemical weapons attack on the Syrian people, killed 1,400 Syrians. This was done by the Assad regime. Here's the problem. There's, first of all, no substantial proof that this is, in fact, what happened, either in terms of the numbers of people killed, whether or not poison gas was actually used, and who may have used it, if in fact that's what's happened. There are many, many alarm bells going off that this could be hyped up intelligence, it could be concocted intelligence, filled with lies and so on and so forth, not the least of which was that the Assad regime right away said that UN inspectors who were on the ground at the time in Syria could go and do an investigation, and the U.S. immediately dismissed, waiting for the results of their findings, and went forward with these charges. And then, of course, we could talk about the fact that the United States itself, when it suits its interests, has used chemical weapons in Iraq over and over again, first in the 80s supporting Saddam Hussein's use of chemical weapons, which led to the murder of tens of thousands of Iranians and thousands of Kurdish people, and the U.S. directly used chemical and nuclear weapons in the form of depleted uranium against Iraq in the 90s and in the 2003 war. So all this shows that the U.S. motivation is not simply humanitarian. It is not simply responding to a chemical weapons attack. And in fact, if you look at the actual arguments that Obama is making and you peel back all the fog and the rhetoric and the hyperbole, you find within this and within the Senate resolution admission of the actual reasons that they're going to war, which are about geopolitics, about imperialism, and about dominating the Middle East.
Well, let me ask you this, Larry, because and it'll lead into that, because that's part of what I want to get into, a big part of what I want to get into. But, you know, even if there had been proof that the Assad regime had used these chemical weapons, as they're accused of using, even if there had been proof, in my thinking, that still would not justify the U.S. going in and doing what they're going to do.
Well, exactly. I mean, the U.S. looks at war crimes and crimes against humanity, whether or concocted, through the lens of what's in it for us. Certainly, both sides in the Syrian civil war have created, committed crimes, have summary executions, killed thousands and thousands of people, and the United States has made a point of not directly intervening militarily. Why? Because they didn't see it to be in their interests at that moment. And up to this point, over 100,000 people in Syria have died, a reported 2 million driven outside the country as refugees. So the question is, why now? This was even raised by one of the senators who said, look, there have been 14 different reports of chemical weapons use. Why now? And that gets to the actual motivations for why the U.S. is going in. There's been a change of momentum favoring the Assad regime over the last several months. And this is what is triggering this threatened and preparations for a military strike and perhaps a wider war against Syria. And if you read what Obama's saying and what the Senate resolution says, it says this is about changing the momentum of the war. That's a geopolitical objective. That isn't anything to do with humanitarianism or preventing and outlawing chemical weapons. And of course, the U.S. focuses great attention to suit their objectives. There's very little discussion in the media about the fact that two key U.S. allies in the region, Egypt and Israel, have both refused to sign the ban against chemical weapons, and both have chemical weapons. And I'm not seeing tons of Senate and House hearings debating all this.
We're talking with Larry Everest, the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, and a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about what's behind the U.S. moves in Syria. Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, one of the things, as you're speaking, I kept thinking, okay, you know, you were talking about there's like these geopolitical interests that are it's an operation here, and I kept thinking about as I was reading and preparing for talking with you, I was thinking about this point that gets into, look, there's part of this is that there's a lot of necessity that the U.S. imperials face in that region right now, not the least of which is the fact that their stalwart power, Egypt, is in such turmoil and that other things are breaking loose all over that region, as well as all the things that this whole thing, situation with Syria is coming at the sort of at the tail end of or has part and parcel of, who knows where it's going to go, but of all the things that have been exposed about U.S. imperialism in the world, they're facing a certain necessity in the region and in general that sort of seems like it's forcing them to do what you're saying in terms of, you know, the action that they're going to take in Syria.
Well, I think you're right, Michael. I mean, think about it. Obama himself has studiously resisted calls to get in the middle of the Syrian conflict for fear that it could strengthen Islamic jihadism, that Syria could break apart, that other pro-U.S. regimes in the region from Jordan to Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and so on could be negatively impacted, even brought down. And, you know, it's a natural question for people to ask. Why would the U.S. get into this potential quagmire, especially when many millions and millions of people in the U.S. don't want this, people around the world don't want this? It's obviously very perilous. And I think the point you're bringing up about the actual necessities faced by imperialism, driving them to take this very high-stakes gamble is on the money. And the key thing is that dominating the Middle East region, which has 60% of the world's oil resources and is a key military and geopolitical crossroads between Africa, Asia, and Europe. Look, many wars have been fought to control the Middle East. This has been a key element of U.S. global power since the end of World War II, because if you control this region, not only do you control trade and military routes, you also exercise dominant influence over the global oil market, therefore having a whip hand over powers that either buy or sell oil. So this is an enormous, you know, these imperialist strategists call it the economic equivalent of nuclear weapons. So this has been critical. And as you say, after September 11th, the Bush administration, seeing that the U.S. grip on this region could be eroded, launched this whole war on terror to reshape this area and to actually strengthen the U.S. hold on this. And my book, Oil, Power, and Empire, remains very relevant to everything that's going on right now. Well, things didn't work out as planned, and as you say, now in the last few years, there's been tremendous upheaval in the region. And the U.S. is afraid at this point that if the Assad regime triumphs, it would strengthen Iran, it would strengthen Iran's allies in Syria, the Assad regime, and also strengthen the Lebanese group Hezbollah. And really, not that those forces could directly attack or take on the U.S. and Israel, but it would represent a shift in the balance of power, and it would represent a further eroding of the U.S. position in the region. It could strengthen Russia. All this is considered totally unacceptable, and this is the actual reason driving the U.S. to take this gamble of attacking Syria.
Let me remind listeners that you tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, author and journalist and writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the situation in Syria. Now, Larry, I'm glad you brought up this point about Iran, because there is this thing, and I think it's interesting to explore this a little bit, this thing that the Edward Luttwak statement about that, how the U.S., you know, and this is something that's been going on where Obama has not been arguing right now for let's right now go in and have regime change and all this other stuff. And I think, and it's tied up with what you were talking about in terms of the motley crew that's on the other side of the fence there facing off against Assad. You've got bad and bad, you know, but you have this thing of that Luttwak argued that the U.S. shouldn't be going for regime change, but the best that they can hope for is a prolonged stalemate, an indefinite draw would be in the best interest of U.S. right now. Let's talk about that. And what that says even about this other thing that you've spoken a lot about in relation to this region, this conflict between imperialism and Islamic fundamentalism.
Well, that's right. And Luttwak also says that basically U.S. policy under Obama has been to let Syria basically twist in the wind, to prolong the civil war and weaken both sides without taking decisive action or giving decisive support to either side. So in this way, the U.S. bears, and this isn't ever talked about, the U.S. bears a huge responsibility for the 100,000 deaths. Not the sole responsibility, they're reactionary actors, as you put it, on both sides of the Syrian conflict, but there's blood on U.S. hands over this conflict in Syria. And this is basically right out of the Iran-Iraq War playbook in many ways, which from 1980 to 1988, the U.S. basically followed this strategy in regard to that war, arming and aiding one side, then the other, preventing either side from winning decisively, weakening both sides. By the end of it, there were over a million casualties in that war. And we're seeing this again. Even in what Obama is proposing now, it's basically a recalibration, at least in terms of what it's been argued now. And let's not forget things can get out of control and go in whole other directions as well. But right now, they're essentially recalibrating that strategy of prolonging the civil war. Only in this instance, what they're doing is trying to tilt the playing field toward the rebels by increasing the arming of the rebels, but mostly by what they are calling degrading the capabilities of the Assad regime. In other words, bombing its military. Now, they're claiming this is simply about chemical weapons, but obviously if you're bombing the Syrian military, it's weakening the Assad regime overall, and it goes way beyond simply any issue of chemical weapons. And the U.S. has a whole history of getting authorizations or passing resolutions for certain actions, and then, of course, they proceed to implement their overall agenda under the rubric of stopping chemical weapons. And I just want to say, this is why you started out saying, and which we've written on Revolution, that nothing good can come from a U.S. intervention in Syria. It's going to lead to more horrors and more bloodshed and more devastation being rained down on the Syrian people.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest. Larry's an author and journalist. He's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about U.S. imperialism and what it's doing in Syria. Well, let me ask you this in relation to that. A friend was recently asking me, and very heartfelt, this point about, well, look, even if everything you're saying is true, doesn't somebody have to do something to stop this horrendous situation in Syria? The fact that the millions have been uprooted, are refugees, the 100,000 dead, all of this, and that there's really posing the point about you just can't, if you care at all about humanity, you just can't stand aside from this. And they cited things like various genocidal assaults that went on through from Rwanda to, you know, the around Yugoslavia and Kosovo and Bosnia and all that, and all these things that happened, and there's no justification for standing aside. And so they were posing it as a real quandary they were facing.
Well, they should be in agony about this, and I think we should not, we, the masses of people, should not stand aside. And look, one of the most reactionary arguments that you're hearing in Congress, including from people who oppose the war, is this doesn't have anything to do with us. We don't even care. That's just American chauvinism, and American lives are the only lives that count, and it's a reactionary and chauvinist position, and that's the position that has enabled the U.S. imperialists to commit such crimes around the world for so long. So we should care. But the way that we can actually do something to benefit humanity is, A, by understanding why the U.S. is going into Syria, what its motives are, and what its results are. And as you pointed out, we've been writing a lot about this on RevCom.us. And then with that understanding and the understanding that the U.S. and U.S. imperialism are the single greatest obstacle to human liberation planet-wide, but particularly in the Middle East at this point, the main thing that people in this country can do who care about the Syrian people, and we all should, there are brothers and sisters like the people of that entire region are, is to oppose the crimes this government is committing on so many fronts. And the other thing that is so, this is one of the things that's so tragic and got to change in both Egypt and Syria and in any place you look. Too much of the conflict in the region is overwhelmingly dominated by a clash between imperialist forces or forces dependent on imperialism or secular reactionary forces like Assad versus Islamic fundamentalism or jihadist or Islamists, which also have no answers and are about imposing other forms of reactionary rule on the people. And what's really urgently needed is a liberatory revolutionary alternative. And there again, I'd very much encourage people to look at RevCom.us, in particular, Bob Avakian's Bringing Forward Another Way, which is a talk about the situation in the Middle East and what's driving the U.S. in this situation. And this is being featured on the website. So I think those are two very important things people can do. And I know that nationwide there are going to be protests against war in Syria, and people should turn out for those.
Well, Larry, as we wind down the interview, the Russians seem to have brokered an agreement with Assad that would mean turning over his chemical weapons to the UN, and it seems like that Obama might be willing to agree to this resolution of things. Now, we're going to have you back this in the next show to talk about all this in greater detail, but right now, what do you make of this?
Well, first, I think we have to understand this latest twist against the backdrop of the really intense contradiction the U.S. imperialists and Obama face in launching an attack against Syria. No good options in the Syrian civil war, differences within the ruling class over what to do, contention with the Russians in this part of the world and generally, and broad public opposition. But basically, Obama didn't agree to really anything just to give this resolution a chance. And let's remember, he's still pursuing his imperialist objectives in Syria, including possibly attacking, but right now he apparently feels compelled, or the best way for him to go forward is by, quote-unquote, giving peace a chance. In other words, giving the appearance that he would wants to have a diplomatic resolution and so on. And if you look at the 1991 and 2003 invasions of Iraq, not that the U.S. is going to invade Syria, but those wars, diplomacy was also an adjunct to war. Because let's face it, imperialist diplomacy is still imperialism. It serves the overall aims of the imperialists. It doesn't serve humanity. And even these UN weapons inspectors in Iraq, for example, were used to attempt to foment coups and spies and so on. So the bottom line, I think, on this is that whether or not an agreement is reached, any U.S. attack or further maneuvers against Syria is going to be carried out for the kind of imperialist motives that we've been talking about here today, not for humanitarianism, and nothing good's going to come of it. But I think it's very important for people to understand, and this latest development just underscores this, that things remain fluid, that everything isn't all set in stone, and this highlights the urgency of really determined mass resistance to stop this war, not breathing a sigh of relief, and seizing on this moment to break people's thinking out of the framework of what's good for America, in other words, for U.S. imperialism, and to what's good for humanity, and to struggle with people about what the actual motives and nature of this empire really are. And on that foundation, really generate massive criticism and opposition to any kind of intervention or attack against Syria.
All right, Larry, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Michael.
All right, and we'll probably talk to you again next week because things are going hot and heavy and the press is on. So probably talk to you again next week, man. All right, take care now.
Okay, see you later.
All right, bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Larry Everest. And Larry's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we've been talking about the situation in Syria and the importance of getting a really, really deep understanding of why this stuff is going on so that we can turn around and change it. And really, I think, emphasizing the point that Larry was making about going out and people being out there and actually taking up this resistance. I also want to tell people that Larry mentioned RevCom.us. Go there. Check out the online edition of the paper. It's called Liar in Chief, From Syria to Black America. You need to check that one out. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joining Sansara Taylor to talk about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, what we learned off of that, what was accomplished, and some stuff around patriarchy and its relationship to the system. So stay tuned. Face of things to come.
tell you about the destruction of all the evil that will have to end.
It will.
Yeah, all right, that's right. Nina Simone, Revolution, Part 1. All right, just a great song and sets a great, great mood for the rest of the show. All right, joining us now is Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and co-founder of StopPatriarchy.org. And she's been on the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. Then we've been talking with Sansara over a number of weeks, and then we weren't able to get back to her when the tour was wrapping up. And I wanted to have her back to talk about what happened at the tail end of the tour, especially when they went into Mississippi, but also what the tour overall accomplished, and then get into as much as we can in this short period of time, get into at least poke at this question of why does the system need patriarchy, all right, and the oppression of women. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. So let's jump into this so we have as much time as we can. When we last spoke, you were headed into the final leg of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, headed into Jackson, Mississippi. Can you remind people real quick what the Freedom Ride was about, and then give us a sense of what you found in Mississippi?
Yes. So the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, we were about a one-month-long Freedom Ride for abortion rights. We took off from both California and New York. We left from both coasts. And we converged. We traveled the entire country. We converged in North Dakota. We traveled down through Wichita, where Dr. George Tiller had been killed, and we culminated in Jackson, Mississippi. So we went from both coasts and down the middle of the country, and we made about 15 different stops in different cities and states along the way. But three of them were the more major stops. That was in Fargo, North Dakota, where there's only one abortion clinic left in the entire state, in Wichita, where Dr. Tiller was assassinated, and in Jackson, Mississippi, where there's also only one abortion clinic in the whole state. And both in Fargo and Mississippi, those clinics are only open because of temporary orders from judges. They have laws that would close them down. They're being challenged, so they're temporarily open, but they're in a battle for their lives, both of those places. And so we did this Abortion Rights Freedom Ride because abortion across the country is in a state of emergency. Record restrictions for the last 3 years in abortion. 50 clinics have been closed in the last 3 years. It's just been getting more and more intense. Abortion is more and more stigmatized. It's very dangerous for the doctors. Their lives are being threatened every day. And we did this to wake people up to this national state of emergency that needs a national counteroffensive, not just local struggles, people trying to keep things together on a local basis. We need a national counteroffensive against this war on women. And we need to tell the truth that this fight has never been about babies. It's always been about control over women, the liberation of women or the enslavement of women. Because if women can't have an abortion, if they can't decide for themselves whether and when they're going to have children, women have no more freedom than slaves. And so we raise the slogan, not please allow us to have some abortions in these rare exceptions, but no, abortion on demand and without apology. Forced motherhood is female enslavement. And we went to set those terms and change those terms throughout the country and bring people forward to fight around that, to go back on the moral and the political offensive. And the third thing we were setting out to do is to really rally people to see the need to rely on ourselves, to build a massive movement of resistance, to defend this right, to expand this right, to defend the clinics and the doctors, and to stop relying on politicians who seek common ground, on the Democratic Party, on the courts, on all of this, you know, power structure over us, which is actually a very oppressive power structure, but to see the potential in the reservoir of people and to mobilize ourselves to stand up and fight for this as part of building up the strength to actually, those of us who understand the need for revolution, to strengthen the basis to make a real revolution that could fully liberate women. So that's in a month-long compressed. And then in Jackson, Mississippi, which is in the Deep South, there is one clinic left in that state. There used to be five not that long ago. It's down to only one. The clinic is protested every single day. The women who come in are harassed and verbally abused. When we were there, we were told to kill ourselves by the anti-abortion protesters. They threatened us. They told us that women shouldn't vote. You get a sense of the Dark Ages mentality. And as I said, this clinic is only open because of a temporary judge's order. And so we went there to rally support for that clinic. Women come from all over the area, you know, hours away, They have a mandatory waiting period, so they have to see the doctor one day, stay in their cars, a lot of them, overnight. They can't afford a place to stay and come back the next day for their abortions. Mostly poor women, overwhelmingly African-American women. Most of them already have children, and this is really their last resort. So we went to rally support for that clinic, and it was a pretty intense and powerful experience. The staff there is incredibly dedicated. The women, there's a small corps of escorts there who help the patients every day. But really, a lot of people beyond that have been, you know, one in three women gets an abortion. When we were out around town, we met a lot of women who told us about their abortions, who support that clinic, who like that clinic. But they've been made so silent and so defensive that it was a big fight with people to say, if you support this, you have to stand up. And we culminated in a rally at the clinic, actually, where people, probably 85 to 100 people, came out and rallied for abortion on demand and without apology, for support for that clinic, including people coming up from places like Houston, Atlanta, Kentucky, and converging to really show national support for that clinic and to strengthen those on the ground who are fighting this battle. So it was a very, very powerful culmination to the whole nationwide abortion rights freedom ride.
Well, let me remind listeners that we're talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper, one of the key initiators of the movement to end pornography and patriarchy, the enslavement and degradation of women, and also of the website stoppatriarchy.org, which is part and parcel of that whole movement. Now, Sansara, one of the things I wanted to ask you, though, is as I was reading the thing, especially about the stuff in Jackson, I was very moved by a lot of the discussions you had with people down there, the things that you found out about people's experience, the need for abortion, you know, and people's attitude towards it, and in particular, the head of the clinic down there. It was really interesting to me, and I was looking at that in terms of the overall mission that you set out to do when you formulated this idea for the abortion rights freedom ride. I wanted to ask you what you're feeling about that in terms of how far did it go in terms of meeting the mission that you set out on, and what were some of the things that you learned off of the freedom ride?
Well, I laid out the three main things we were fighting to accomplish, and I think in a very significant dimension and from different angles, we made big advances in each of those three things and really knitting together, you know, hundreds of people around the country to begin a national network, a national movement to stand up against this. We changed a lot of people's thinking, and which I think cannot be overstated how important that is. The difference between, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners, I'm speaking directly to you right now, a lot of people, they say, I'm pro-choice, but, you know, not only in cases of rape, or I'm pro-choice, but abortion shouldn't be used like birth control, or I'm pro-choice, but, you know, it really is, it's kind of sad. And really, we changed a lot of people's thinking. We challenged that to say, look, if you don't stand up and demand abortion on demand without apology, right now, if we don't fight for that, we're going to lose this right. And fetuses are not babies. It's not murder. Women are not incubators. There's nothing wrong with it. There's no but should be involved. We told people, if you think abortion on demand without apology is too extreme, then which women do you think should be forced to have children against their will, and which women do you think should feel ashamed and have to apologize for getting an abortion? And we had this argument on a mass scale, and both on the street when we did outreach and through the protests that we did, but also through the media coverage we got. I think we reached tens of thousands of people across the country with this message, and a lot of people's minds were changed on that. We met people at every stop who stepped forward to speak unapologetically about their own abortions, about why they support abortion rights. It was very impressive, the number of people. This really, I had not anticipated. It was very moving to me. How many women, older women, who remember the days before Roe versus Wade, came forward and they told stories I'm sure they've not told in decades, if ever, and never publicly, about their own abortions when it was illegal, the humiliation, the danger, the terror that they went through, and about friends of theirs who lost their lives because they had illegal, dangerous, botched abortions and bled to death. And they were telling the truth about the stakes that are facing women if we don't turn the tide. And I think this was very powerful. Even if it's beginning, there are very powerful cores of people. Those who already felt that way got connected up and given backing, and many other people began to change their thinking and see that we need to take the moral offensive, not just because it's useful to us, but because it's true and it's correct, that there's nothing wrong with this procedure. And it's central. This is another thing people don't understand, that a lot of people don't understand why there's such an attack on abortion. This gets to the last question that we'll touch on, but why? You know, we heard over and over again, why doesn't Rick Perry in Texas, why doesn't he get a hobby? Why is he so obsessed with taking away women's right to abortion? Why don't these protesters harassing women every day, why don't they have anything better to do? They don't understand that actually the fight over abortion is not incidental. It's not because people have nothing better to do. It's because there is a very organized, powerful Christian fascist movement that grasps the centrality of abortion to defining what role women will have in society. When women are forced to have children against their will, that forecloses their lives. It takes them out of the public sphere. It brings them back into the role of being breeders and chattel and property of men. And that's not incidental. It's very much part of the plan. And this is something I think a lot of people came to understand much more deeply through this ride, which has a big effect on how much they're going to fight. And that brings me to the last point, where there was a lot of people, there were hundreds of people, who began to get organized and mobilized. Hundreds of people in many parts of the country, including places we didn't go to, who rode in and heard about this ride. And other stops that we added on at the end, that we went to Albuquerque, North Carolina. There was places that we added that weren't in the original plan because people reached out to us. But there was hundreds of people who got organized to actually build a movement that is relying on ourselves. And so that's a very essential, I think, look, we are far from turning the tide and winning this fight. But the things that we accomplished with this Freedom Ride and the things we began and the lessons we learned, those are absolutely essential. And if there's going to be a turning of the tide, which we're going to continue to fight for, and everybody listening should go to revcom.us and get connected, go to stoppatriarchy.org and get connected and be part of this. But the ability to do that is greatly increased, the capacity and the understanding and the leadership core that was forged through this ride. I mean, a couple dozen people who went across the country like this and have been transformed through this, this is essential to going forward and building and has greatly strengthened our capacity to actually go forward on this basis.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she's one of the key initiators of StopPatriarchy.org. All right, well, let's hit this last question. We've got about 4 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes to deal with this, and we'll have you back to talk about this because it was such a killer question for a lot of people in the audience that a lot of my listeners actually really wanted to discuss this. So I do have plans on having you back for an extended period, maybe the entire show, where we can talk about this in depth and then take calls. But let's talk about this. Why does this system, why is it that you say that patriarchy and the oppression of women is absolutely essential to this system? The system actually requires that.
Well, I think it's a very important question. And it is important for us to discuss this today and more in depth. But every single system that has required and that is based on the division of society into different classes, not just into rich and poor, but into antagonistic classes, those who own the major means of production and run the whole world and organize the economy, and those who actually have no say and no ownership of the, you know, maybe you own your clothes and your stuff, your personal stuff, but you don't own factories, you don't own land, you don't own big chunks of land that are farmed and all of this, you don't own shipping, all of the things that mines, all the things that make the requirements of life. The people who don't own any of that but can just rent themselves out to those who do and labor, that's a class division. When you have that, you need, it seems unrelated to the role of women in society, but you actually need women in a subjugated role. Every society divided into classes, whether it be slave society, feudal society, or this so-called free but highly oppressive capitalist imperialist society, you need women in a subordinate place because you have to control women's sexuality and women's reproduction. It is very central to controlling who's going to be born into what position, who's going to be born into the future, you know, the future burger flippers and inmates and soldiers and cannon fodder, and who's going to be born into a position where they're going to be the future leaders of the society, the future rulers, the future capitalists and exploiters. And I know in capitalism there's individual mobility, so it gets obscured, because you could be on the bottom and work your way to the top, or you could be on the top and you could fall to the bottom. But as a whole, people actually need to be born into different categories, different castes, different social roles. And to do that, you have to control women's reproduction. You have to know whose children belong to whom, which man is giving birth, you know, is bearing which children. And that emerged at a certain point. It hasn't always been with us. Before there were classes, there was not the patriarchal control over women's bodies, women's sexuality, women's childbirth. And even in this society, the family unit, I mean, look, if you don't have parents and a family unit, that determines how the kids are going to be raised, how they're going to be, whether they're going to be fed and clothed or whether they're going to be on the street. Children are a private concern. That's privatized in the family, and that requires women in a subjugated role. It's not human nature. It is really the nature of how people have been shaped by this system. And there's a lot of socialization that goes into it. From the day that the little girl is born and they put a baby doll in her hand and they start training her from day one to be a mother, it's a necessary role in a capitalist society every bit as much as it is in a feudal society or a slave society to have women caring for the domestic life, rearing the children, even today you have these big dilemmas, even for women who make it into the higher echelons of capitalist society, professional life or military life or any of this, even among the capitalist class itself, they still have that burden of how are they caring for the children and what's their most important role that society views them as having is that of being mothers. And that's socially conditioned. That's not human nature. And that's part of the oppression of women in this society. And then the last thing I'll say is that, especially in this historical moment, when there is so much turmoil in the world, so much change going on, so much upheaval. I mean, you just had Larry Everest speaking about Syria, but you could put your finger down any part of the globe, in Egypt, in Brazil, in Greece, in all over the Middle East, and in this country with a lot of insecurity and upheaval in people's lives, there is the reassertion of patriarchy, of the oppression of women. That's part of where this attack on women's abortion rights and also the viciousness and the increasing violence in pornography, there's the reassertion of patriarchy as a social glue to hold together a society that's pulling apart in many different ways. And I think it's a very, very big ideological core and glue to the whole functioning of this society in its militaries, in its culture, and in the war on women that's being fought out right now.
All right, Sansara, I look forward to talking with you about that, and I'm sure our listeners do too. So we'll spend quite a bit of time on that coming up real soon, all right?
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Okay. Thanks a lot for joining us today, too. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, who writes for Revolution Newspaper and is also one of the initiators of StopPatriarchy.org, and you should visit that website. There's a lot of important stuff in there. Also, go to RevCom.us. In addition to the online extra edition of Revolution Newspaper, which is actually headlined Liar-in-Chief, From Syria to Black America, and they're talking about what's going on with Barack Obama and the whole situation in the entire society, all right? And so that's really well worth checking out. Also, you can find A Declaration for Women's Liberation and the Emancipation of All Humanity, a very interesting piece. You can get that on that site. And it's essential reading, actually, to take up some of these critical questions in the world today. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Wayne Kramer and Billy Bragg. And I'm very excited about that. And you should be, too. So stay tuned. Welcome back. Jail Guitar Doors from The Clash. All right. And The Clash is kind of gathered here in the background in everybody's memory right now and in the reality of Jail Guitar Doors. And I'm joining us to talk about Jail Guitar Doors, what it is, what's going on, what they're doing, and some things in general as well is Billy Bragg, singer-songwriter General Hellraiser. Wayne Kramer, the same thing goes for you, brother. It's good to see you again, as I was telling you. And I got to say that these are two cats that actually have spent a good deal of their life, not just given to the world, all right, but given to the creation of a culture of revolt against a revolting culture, which is something we really need.
You know,
so both of you, Wayne, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Happy to be here.
Michael, very pleased to be here.
Yeah, good. Well, let's start with Jail Guitar Doors. What is it? I mean, actually, maybe we can start with Billy, because you were one of the people that actually organized it in the first place.
Right? Yeah, basically, in 2007, I got a letter from a fellow who was working in a prison near where I live in England called Guy's Marsh Prison. And he was a drug and alcohol rehabilitation officer, trying to engage these guys with substance problems to get onto the program. And he also played the guitar, and he was found that by offering to teach them guitar, they would come along every week. But he only had one guitar in the prison that belonged to the vicar, and the vicar took it home at weekends to play Kumbaya on it or whatever. And so I suppose I'm the kind of local rock star, he got in touch with me to see if I had any spare guitars. So I went along to see the work he was doing, and it was really impressive. So I thought it would be something that as a musician maybe I should be doing, because I know as a musician that playing a musical instrument can help you to transcend your surroundings momentarily. And obviously in a prison situation, to be able to do that is very, very valuable without messing up your metabolism. It's very, very, very valuable. So I worked with him, got him the guitars, and decided that I would use his contacts to try and find other people like him working within the prison system, and try to supply them with whatever musical instruments they needed. I spoke to some other musicians, and it was the 5th anniversary of the death of Joe Strummer, lead singer of The Clash, and I was looking to do something to memorialise Joe. He was a huge influence on me and a lot of people. And so I thought this is the sort of thing maybe The Clash would be doing, so I decided to name it after that Clash B-side you just played, Jail Guitar Doors.
And that Clash B-side, Jail Guitar Doors, had something very special to do with our other guest, Wayne Kramer. Wayne, let's take it up from here.
Well, in the 1970s, I went through a rough period, made some terrible decisions, and ended up serving a federal prison term. While I was incarcerated, this new music form emerged called punk rock. And there was this band from England called The Clash, very conscious band, who talked about their community, talked about the world around them, told the truth about what was going on, and chronicled my bad behavior in this song, me and a couple other guys, which I thought was a great show of solidarity. You know, I didn't know these guys, but from musician to musician, I appreciate it. Didn't think much of it until about 5 years ago. I was I just had to answer the call to go back into the prisons and do something in the face of this disgrace of mass incarceration in our country. I just watched it build for 30 years and felt compelled to take some ethical action. So I gathered up a bunch of my friends that were musicians, and one of them was Billy. And we went into Sing Sing, and we played for the men, and it was a great event. And we got a program started there, and he had Jail Guitar Doors written on his guitar. And I said, "That's interesting." He said, "Oh, yeah, have you ever heard it? It's an old Clash B-side."
And Wayne said to me, rather embarrassingly, Wayne said to me, "Yes, I'm in it." Which was totally, to me, that's one of those moments when you wish the ground would open up. So I kind of knew that. I don't know what I was thinking. So that was sort of the beginning of JGD USA.
Yeah, it was. The more we talked about it, the more everything he said made perfect sense to me. And I thought, you know, that's great that he does that work in England. He's British, but, you know, I'm here. I'm an American, and I'm a musician. Maybe I could be that bridge in this country. And so now we're 4 or 5 years down the line. We're in about 35 American prisons with a waiting list of another 42. And we've got programs in the Cook County jail system in Chicago and Illinois, in New York and Sing Sing in Texas. We've been approached by the Philadelphia County Prison System to bring guitars and build a program there, and we have musicians out there now lined up, operatives to take over the work. So, you know, we're moving forward, and today we had incredible news. We secured a small grant to help us do some more work, and here we are.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Wayne Kramer, the voice you just heard, and Billy Bragg, the voice you heard a little few minutes ago saying, "I didn't know that Wayne Kramer was in Jail Guitar Doors."
You'll never live
that down.
In my defense, the next time I saw Mick Jones, who wrote Jail Guitar Doors, I related this story to him, and I said to him, and then he said, "I'm in the song." And Jones, he said to me, "Is he?" So I think, you know.
Oh,
I think
we have to do something about this.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, I didn't feel so bad after that. I thought I'd better fess up to Mick.
Well, Wayne is steaming over here now.
Listen, I love these guys so much. Yeah. You know,
well, Wayne's a hero to us as well. You know,
I mean, believe me.
And I have to say, there could be no better person to do this kind of work, because Wayne's experience, not only having been incarcerated, but his knowledge of the system. This is not a job for any musician. You know, I was very fortunate in that I had very good connections at the time with the Labour government, with their prisons department. I knew the guy who was the minister there. So that gave me a little inward track. But Wayne's experience here in his own advocacy working in the prison system in California has been invaluable to being built something like Jail Guitar.
And it's made, look, here's the point, it's made a huge difference. I mean, we've participated in different things that were going on. And you know, the fact that one of the points that you raised, and I think both of you raised, and I think Jail Guitar Doors raises, but in particular when you were raising, and I remember the first time I heard you speak about this, you did that statement that you usually say, which, my name's Wayne Kramer, for a long time I was, and then you gave your number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I kept thinking about that because, and even when I was looking at this, you guys familiar with Chuck Brown from D.C.?
Of course.
Okay, yeah, you sure. know, and the cat, you know how he's actually credited a lot with playing a big role in developing go-go music.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just such a killer music. Yeah, I love that, right? Mm-hmm. And it's been squashed too, which is just criminal. But Chuck used to tell me he got a guitar when he was in Lorton Prison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was a broken down old piece of whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he just started playing, and he dedicated himself. And he talked about this whole point of transformation. And it was from that actually go-go came out and spread like crazy. And really, I think, is really a really intense and sadly ignored form of music. And I think we really need to change that. But I wanted to read something from a letter that you got, Wayne, from a prisoner. And it was off of an experience you had out of prison. I think it might have been out at Lancaster. And it says, just as importantly to this experience of having the concert and whatnot, just as importantly to this experience, though, was that for those couple of hours, we were human beings enjoying music performed by talented artists. And it's the human being part that matters the most, I believe. Prison tends to deny humanity to prisoners. We are crimes in bed spaces, inmates to be shuffled around like chunks of matter devoid of sentience. But knowing that a group of talented artists took the time out of their lives to come and entertain us sent the inescapable message that prisoners long to hear. You are human beings just like us, and we care about your welfare. That's bigger than just about anything else I can imagine. And I was really moved by that when I read it, and I kept thinking, wow, what that has to do with Jail Guitar Doors is incredible.
Just to know that there are people outside who give a damn about you when you're in there. I mean, you know, when I'm doing gigs and raising funds in the UK, you know, I make a pitch for the prisoners. I represent for those guys inside. But when I'm inside, my duty is to represent for the people who put the money in the bucket. And the intention with which they put that money in the bucket, the intention being that, you know, they want you to get out of prison and never come back, mate. So don't take this guitar as a gift. It's just a challenge. When you accept this guitar from me, I look people in the eye. I physically hand out the guitars when I go in. That's most of the work I do. Go in, meet the guitar group, hand out the instruments. But I represent for those people who put money in the buckets. And just to know that outside there's someone who's thinking about people who have been incarcerated and hoping that they can get out of, you know, break that revolving door, which many of them are stuck in. I think that's a real important part of what we do, as well as supplying them with musical instruments, encouraging them to play, encouraging them to express themselves through music. Just that knowledge that someone outside is thinking about them is something special, because there's something more personal about getting a guitar rather than getting some sort of vocational skill where it's just a sort of education and you're taught by rote. A guitar that you can take back to your cell, that you can use, that becomes part of you, it's a different kind of intervention. And that's our hope, that we, you know, we work and trust the people working on the inside who understand that, who realise that, people who play themselves, to utilise the instruments that we donate, that the public donate, to try and find those people who can respond to that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I have a friend in the sheriff's department who's an ally of JGD, and he told me, you know, education is crucial. Half the prisoners in California cannot read, so education is crucial. But he said education isn't enough. He said, if I educate a criminal, I've got an educated criminal. It needs a change of heart. And the only thing that we know that will change someone on that fundamental level is art itself. You know, dance, music, writing, theater, sculpture, painting, anything. Because art, working at art, teaches a person the secret of how to work, how to stay focused on something that you're motivated to do. And that sense of accomplishment rebuilds that self-respect and the dignity that we lose in that environment. That environment's designed to tell you you have no value in the world.
And I'll just add real quick, because unfortunately, time just shot by. We should have you guys back. If you stay in town, come back, all right? We could actually
We'd love to do that.
One thing I would add really quick is that this point about that this prisoner wrote to you about the humanity, and having gone through right now the prison hunger strike, the point that these guys have been vilified, dehumanized, objectified, and assertion of humanity, and then people being able to embrace a very core element of humanity in terms of expression and all this, and creation, all this other stuff, really important in terms of
work. Billy just said the UN says 15 days of solitary, after 15 days is torture.
Right, exactly. All right, well, let's do it again. All right, you're listening to The Michael State Show. I'm your host and producer, Michael State. We've been talking with Wayne Kramer and Billy Bragg. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having us, Michael.
See you
really
tonight.
Appreciate it.
Definitely, definitely. All right, we're just about ready to wrap up another show, but before we do, I want to read you something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. The interests, objectives, and grand designs of the imperialists are not our interests. They are not the interests of the great majority of people in the U.S., nor of the overwhelming majority of people in the world as a whole. And the difficulties the imperialists have gotten themselves into in pursuit of these interests must be seen and responded to not from the point of view of the imperialists and their interests, but from the point of view of the great majority of humanity and the basic and urgent need of humanity for a different and better world, for another way. Again, that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and you can find that in his book, Basics. All right, well, that does bring us to the end of the show. And I want to thank all of my guests today, Larry Everest, Sansara Taylor, Wayne Kramer, and Billy Bragg. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can. If you do it unobtrusively and not creepily, you don't creep me out. All right, you can do that through Twitter and Facebook. And if you want to check out my blog, it's michaelslate.wordpress.com. And if you want to actually help in the show in any way at all, just drop me a line at michaelslate@redfuture.com, and we'll get back in touch with you right away. There's a whole lot of ways that you can contribute no matter where you are in the country, all right? All right, and we're going to go out now with a piece from Billy Bragg's last album, his latest album, and it's one that really got me, okay, because it's about tomorrow's going to be a better day, and I really like that.
No matter what the siren voices say, tomorrow's gonna be a better day. We're gonna make it that way. Pessimistic populists who harbor no doubt that every day we make our way to hell in a handcart. And the snarky said, "Who's snapping to get anyone who sticks their head above the parapet? Well, don't be disheartened, baby, don't be it from someone who knows the glass is half full and tomorrow's gonna be a better day, no matter what the siren.